Welcome to Making a Meal of It, the podcast for eaters of all appetites who want to reimagine and reinvigorate their relationships with food, food culture, and food systems. I'm your host, David Santo, a writer, teacher, and artist working in and with food. Today's show focuses on the tensions that arise among and within food systems, including the conflicted relationships between colonialism and indigenous foodways, and between food, technology, and the biogeophysical environment. That's nature in less fancy words. Overall, we're talking about sustainability and fairness and well-being, and the ways in which different worldviews and priorities are at the heart of many food-related and social challenges. But first, tune your oral receptors to this. That was the sound of the military-industrial food complex. Yeah, right. It was a microwave oven heating up a dish of leftover pasta. But along with saran wrap, chocolate bars, Corningware, synthetic fertilizers, and a bunch of other kitchen technologies, the microwave oven was born out of military and wartime research and development. Wars, both cold and hot, have long been a source of scientific and technological innovation, and in times of relative peace, the industries that profit dramatically from supplying armed conflict often turn their capitalist eyes to the domestic sphere. Canned food is another prime example of that. It became a really big part of our industrial foodscape right after World War I when it was introduced to battlefields across Europe. Curiously, the invention of the can opener came after the development of putting food in metal tins. Soldiers initially had to use their bayonets to crack into their field food rations. This episode was originally going to be about that history of food and war and technology. But when I started thinking more carefully about some of the questions I wanted to explore, I realized there are some conflicts that are even more embedded and more fundamental to what's going on with food today. Here in Canada, we are very slowly, but steadily, working our ways towards building more respectful, more honest, more equitable relationships among Indigenous peoples, communities with immigrant and colonizing heritage, and the regional and federal governments with which we try to manage ourselves. Reconciliation is a long and painful process, and that's partly because we who participate in it generally come from very, very different worldviews and systems of just understanding how things are. At the heart of those knowledge systems are our relationships with the land, air, and water of the places where we live. In one way of seeing things, the land is our mother, our home, our responsibility, and in fact, ourselves. So nurturing it in a reciprocal way is the only path towards a good present and a sustained future. From a more exploitative, wealth-generating worldview, the land is just a resource, one from which we extract value. It's an unending source of wealth and profit. But the problem with that perspective is that it's just wrong. Our lands and seas and airs are not unending resources, unless, of course, they are very, very carefully attended to, cared for, and listened to. But along with production practices that exploit people's labor and dump waste materials back into those same environments, our corporate ways of making food are doing serious damage, in part because they depend on this worldview that simply isn't coherent. So in many ways, the key word for this episode is with, W-I-T-H. With is one of those words that philosophers and artists and theoreticians use to signal reciprocity and relationality, exchange, fairness, balance, and even hope. It's a counterpoint to the idea that humans are in charge of things or at the top of a food chain or a system of control. It's also a challenge to the sense that nature, our biological, geographical, physical ecologies, nature is somehow in service to people and governments and industries. But that's not what our relationship with nature is. We are with it. We are with the land and the waters and the air, not their master and commander, and certainly not their owner. So being a little less top-down, in fact, a lot less top-down, is the only way that humanity is going to keep going on this planet. Of course, that assumes that humanity's continued existence is a good thing. I mean, I tend to think so, but it's not necessarily a given when you take a bigger perspective on, well, life. Anyway, that's a subject for another episode, or maybe just for another podcast altogether. To help us think through and unpack some of the conflicts within food systems and with other systems, I have two conversations to share today. The first is with a teacher and learner of Indigenous food knowledge who gives a course on the subject in Canada's first and only undergraduate program in food studies. The second is with an artist and science communicator, an activist, a food maker. Yep, that's just one person. And then later, during the Stick This In Your Mouth segment, Maxime and I will eat Christmas cake way out of season. And then we wrap it all up with responses to the food questionnaire from one of the single most inspiring people I have ever met. First up, Jane Claus, the project's coordinator for the Laurier Center for Sustainable Food Systems and the UNESCO Chair on Food, Biodiversity, and Sustainability Studies. Jane developed and teaches the Indigenous Food Systems course in the Bachelor of Food Studies program at George Brown College in Toronto, Ontario, and she's a registered band member of the Six Nations of the Grand River. Well, Jane, thank you so much for joining me on Making a Meal of It. I am delighted to be talking to you about you and your work. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
So you teach a course about Indigenous food systems in the recently launched undergrad program in food studies at George Brown College in Toronto. Can you tell me a bit about that and why it's so important for food studies students to be learning about Indigenous food knowledge right now?
Yeah, for sure. So it's the first Indigenous food course in that program. So it's definitely an important step. It's also my first experience developing a course of that nature. In terms of the importance, there's, you know, a lot of thinking and writing around the fact that in a settler colonial state such as Canada, learning about Indigenous histories, Indigenous rights are pretty foundational to any educational program, that you can't really say much about Canada without saying something about Indigenous peoples. And within food studies more specifically, you know, these conversations around sustainable food systems, agroecology, regenerative agriculture, these things have really longstanding histories in a lot of Indigenous cultures. And so it's really a disservice to offer a food studies program that doesn't, you know, acknowledge these roots and these foundations. And by that, I mean, you know, a disservice to the students, to the rigor of the program, and then, you know, of course, to Indigenous peoples who deserve that voice and have been fighting for that voice for a long time.
Is that something that you see as a positive step forward in the larger world of reconciliation in Canada?
For sure. I think that the conversations around reconciliation can perhaps feel demotivating at times for settler positions. And I think within food studies, we can all agree that there's something special about conversations around food. And I think that that can definitely bring a special angle into the conversation that can be a great way to help people feel like they can engage in these conversations and have sort of tangible actions and steps forward in that arena.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, it's hard. This is a hard process and it requires all of us to be engaged in it. But as you say, food is such a useful and emotional and embodied way to come together. Tell me a bit about how you view Indigenous food systems and food knowledge and food ways as being different from the very widespread transnational, industrial, corporate food systems that much of the world is embedded in right now. I know it's a sort of a huge question. What's the difference between this and this? But I think somewhere in there, there's an interesting tension and set of conflicts that are important to talk about and to be figured out.
Yeah, I think it is a massive question, and it's something that I struggled with in developing the course. Statistics Canada puts First Nations in the country at around 630. Then that's at least 630 complex and unique food systems that I'm being asked to summarize in an introductory course. Of course, everyone understands that's not super feasible. So if I were to talk about main themes, you know, I tend to talk about how indigenous food systems are relational, reciprocal, ethical, very place-based and territorial, community-specific even. You know, I'm Haudenosaunee and Haudenosaunee food might not even look the same between my community and another community. So there's a lot of nuance there. Indigenous food systems are more respectful of the relationship between all things, nature, plants, animals, people, minimally intervening, really concerned with regenerating and reciprocating back what's taken. You know, there's a lot of conversation to be had around the way Western agriculture is very industrial, is very monocrop, heavy on inputs, chemicals. And, you know, we don't see those things in traditional indigenous growing systems. So there's a lot of contrast there. And then I like to also maybe give like a few examples. So food guides are a great way to kind of see the differences between systems. So I go through a Haudenosaunee food guide that was developed on Six Nations of the Grand River. And you can see even in the arrangement of the food guide, how different the philosophical, the kind of conceptual differences are between the two. You know, there's an emphasis on connecting food to where it comes from. Yeah, so I mean, it's a huge question, but I think those are some of the things that I like to highlight.
Well, yeah, thank you for doing that, because I even as I pose the question, I know it's a bit of a ridiculous one, because it's like saying, could you describe the food of the planet, or could you describe the food of Europe, or anything like that? As I have understood it, there's this term pan-indigeneity, which basically is the problematic effect of conflating all indigenous peoples and communities into one group. And that's what we really want to avoid when talking about anything, including indigenous food systems. So what you're saying is really anytime food is talked about within indigenous knowledge construct, you want to be specific. Instead of saying, oh, this is what all indigenous people do, blah, blah, blah. That's not helpful. It's about being specific to the community, specific to the people, specific to the place. That's what we should be doing in all cases. It's a bit like when people say, well, what's Canadian food? Well, Canadian food is diverse. Why would we ever say that indigenous food is not diverse?
Yeah, there is an interesting history to pan-indigeneity. I think that a lot of it can be situated in early indigenous sovereignty movements. At the time, it was called Pan-Indianism, and it's associated with perhaps groups like the American Indian Movement in sort of the 40s, 50s, 60s. And at that time, it was an intentional choice to present a united front in hopes that that would make a stronger case for political demands. But hopefully, by now, we're reaching a point where Indigenous peoples can have different and, you know, even conflicting political concerns, and that can be okay, and that Indigenous peoples don't have to reduce themselves to one-dimensional versions and sort of paint this idea that we all are the same, we all agree, you know, we all want the same things. It's certainly not true, and I think that it doesn't feel full or genuine to be engaging in that anymore.
So part of the work of the people who are in non-marginalized groups is to better understand that diversity and get close to it, presumably, and learn in specific ways rather than believing sweeping generalizations.
Proximity is an interesting thing to consider, and something that I thought a lot about in developing and teaching this course. I think one thing we've learned in academia is that we've actually often had excessive and extractive proximity and access to Indigenous knowledge, and that hasn't necessarily been a useful path towards reconciliation.
So that's when scholars or researchers go and basically use a community as a research subject, but don't collaborate in the research process?
Yeah, I mean, there's huge histories, very long histories of extractive research processes where whole careers were built on non-consensual research projects with Indigenous people, even Indigenous children, and that didn't benefit those groups at all. And, you know, we still see that to some extent today in more subtle ways, where the knowledge produced, the communications, the reports, the benefits of the project are not adequately shared with the community.
Yeah. And well, that's been a problem with a lot of different forms of research over the history of academic research, is that it's usually to the benefit of the academics and not to the people or the things that are being studied.
Yeah. So my approach to teaching the course is less about transferring knowledge from me to my students, and more about creating a space and a conversation for how to ethically engage with Indigenous peoples and their knowledge on the foundation that it is their knowledge and it won't be your knowledge, even as you learn about it. And I think that, of course, sharing the things I learn about my culture and my community is a really important exercise in demonstrating the beauty and the sacredness of Indigenous knowledge. But I think my main hope is that by demonstrating that beauty, it will motivate young food studies scholars to act in meaningful allyship.
That allyship is really so central. So you're creating a new generation of food studies allies who can be part of this big process. I mean, is that fair to say? Is that too grand?
I mean, yeah, that's a little grand, but I hope to at least maybe create one okay. ally.
Yeah, well, and one will then create another and create another, and sharing this idea, because it's really about unlearning a lot of what we think academic knowledge is or knowledge about food is, and also unlearning the sometimes well-intentioned idea that all knowledge should be open and free. And in fact, some knowledges are meant to be held by people and not freely disseminated around the world. And that's another thing that we need to learn, that, for example, not all Indigenous food knowledge is to be shared with non-Indigenous people.
Yeah, I think it's just a question of, if you take Indigenous knowledge out of the context of Indigenous communities, then it doesn't have the same meaning. It doesn't have the same weight. And so it's just a question of whether it's right or useful for that knowledge to be translated, and how much translation until there is inaccuracies in the knowledge and those sorts of things. So even in my own life, I remind myself that appreciating something doesn't mean that I need to own it.
Well, and that's a very consumerist and capitalist and Western notion, that if you like something, you should take it, you should have it, you should possess it, you should own it, you should buy it, whatever. And that's really very much a biased way of thinking. So tell me about your food. If we're talking about not generalizing and not being too broad or pan-Indigenous, tell me about what you find most interesting about your Haudenosaunee food. If you care to share. Sorry, here I am trying to extract knowledge from you. I'm sorry.
No, I think everything is interesting. It's a huge privilege to learn things about my own culture throughout life. And so I'm, you know, endlessly fascinated with everything. I think specific to my community or my home reserve, there's a lot of great things going on. So, you know, I can give a few shout outs. There's Yowego, which is Chef Tanya Brandt's Haudenosaunee fusion. So it's a bit of traditional and modern. She has a restaurant and a catering service there. And there's, you know, Guyanese Greenhouse, which is a native plant propagation and ecological restoration initiative. There's a great article in Canadian Food Studies Journal about the Healthy Roots and Our Sustenance initiatives on Six Nations, which actually generated the Haudenosaunee Food Guide that I mentioned and teach in my class. So,
and I will include all of those references and links in the show notes for our listeners who are interested in learning more.
Yeah, there's way too much to mention. I mean, Haudenosaunee food is so rich. But I think that if I were to give sort of one example of the food that really kind of sums up the food culture and values, is the Three Sisters planting method. So I find myself really drawn to that. It's intercrop or companion crop planting with corn, bean, and squash. And it's also indigenous to other nations, and every nation has their own story and their own practice with it. For us, the Three Sisters are part of some versions of the Haudenosaunee creation story. Mm-hmm. Essentially, corn, bean, and squash are said to have grown out of the body of Sky Woman when she sacrificed herself for Haudenosaunee life in general. And so, you know, they grew out of her body together. And so we grow them together. They're planted together so that they can support each other. So the corn provides a pole for the beans to grow up, and the beans provide nitrogen to the soil for the health of the other plants. And so it's a lesson that things are stronger when together. And I think what resonates the most for me with that is that this relationality of Haudenosaunee culture is really present in, you know, all things, like down to the way that we grow food. So philosophical and ethical lessons are built into even the way that we learn to grow food. And I think that's really powerful. And also just the way that food and story are so intertwined. I think that the Three Sisters and the creation story is a great example of the way that within my culture and a lot of other Indigenous cultures, food is so wrapped up with story. Food is present as a person, as a lesson, as a life, as a gift in so many of our stories. So I think that of all the things, I find myself perhaps most drawn to the Three Sisters.
Thank you so much for sharing that story and sharing all of the knowledge that you have this afternoon. I really appreciate your time, and I'm so glad that this course exists, and I wish you all the best of luck in the continuing teaching of it and all the creation of future allies.
Hopefully
there will be strong relationships developed throughout all of our careers.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks so much.
And check out our show notes for links to Jane's projects, including her publications on how improving communications is key to making Canada's seasonal agricultural worker program fairer and more just for temporary farming employees. My next guest is Zach Denfield. Zach is co-founder, along with Catherine Kramer, of the Center for Genomic Gastronomy, an artist-led think tank that examines the biotechnologies and biodiversity of human and food systems. Since 2010, the center's artists have been presenting their research through lectures, performances, publications, meals, and exhibits. By collaborating with scientists and chefs and hackers and farmers, they map food controversies and tensions within food systems, all the while imagining ways to prototype alternative culinary futures. Zach, thank you so much for being here from the Center for Genomic Gastronomy. Can you just tell me a bit about what that center is all about and why you use the words genomic and gastronomy?
Yeah, sorry, the name is not the easiest to say, but when we started 13 years ago now, those were kind of the two topic areas we were most interested in, which was kind of food cultures and the life sciences. So gastronomy we use because we work as artists, and we think of gastronomy as the art of choosing, cooking, and preparing good food. And by genomics, we just mean the interactions between organisms and environments and each other and within themselves, and sort of all of the new tools we have to understand biology at these different scales and levels.
Okay, so it's about bringing together two sort of meta concepts, in fact, and putting them together within a rubric of art and creation and play in some ways.
Yeah, and I think the two kind of phrases we will use is that we study the organisms and environments manipulated by human food cultures. We also say that we study the biodiversity and biotechnologies of human food systems.
Very systemic, in fact, you know, looking at ecologies and things interacting with each other to give a kind of a bigger, more complexified view of the world.
Yeah, and I think that because it's food, there's often an edible component, and we're kind of drilling down to that moment where these concepts or these systems manifest as ingredients or recipes or, let's say, restaurants, and then how all that kind of upstream systemic activity has consequences for the downstream experiences we have as eaters.
So some not so cheerful subjects, but you actually, in my experience of your work, you infuse an awful lot of humor into what you do. And sometimes it's pretty dark humor, but it is also witty and playful as much as it is serious and critical.
I think there's enough challenging things happening in the world that both to keep ourselves sane and to keep ourselves hopeful and moving forward, we need to be able to laugh at the world. And like you said, sometimes it's dark humor and sometimes it's hopefully a joyous humor. And we also find that when people are laughing, they tend to not be able to fall into the normal patterns of thinking.
Yeah. So tell me about some of the projects that you've been working on lately or past projects that you have found have been particularly effective and had the impact that you were trying to achieve.
Well, I think in terms of what we've been working on lately, we've noticed a shift in our work from the early 2010s, where we were doing a lot of work around critiquing biotechnology and cultures of biotechnology, to more contemporary work where we're kind of obsessed with agricultural biodiversity. So that's like food forests, permaculture, and all kinds of alternative farming. I think in terms of work that we've done in the past that had the impact we want, right away we did a project back in 2010 called Glowing Sushi, where we were looking at the first transgenic fish that you could buy in the U.S. And there was a lot of hype at that time around Aqua Bounty salmon. So we found this transgenic zebrafish and made a cooking show on YouTube around it. And I think why that was so effective was that some of the advocates for GM technology, some of the hype coming out of industry and some science labs were really confounded. What are these crazy people doing online cooking with this GM fish that nominally is being sold as a pet? And so I think that was a moment where we got to speak to an expert audience who somehow were surprised that people are going to do unexpected things with technology. That started to form an opening or a bridge to inquire more deeply about why so many people around the world are potentially frustrated about GM technology. Because a lot of the experts working in that space, especially if they're not working for the larger corporations, if they're at a university, they feel like they're contributing positively to the world. And they're so surprised why there's this major backlash. And so anyway, so that piece started a lot of have some of those conversations, in part because it was a very dark humor, but disrupted the assumptions about the sort of savior complex of like GM rice, and then forced the lens back on these other things that, you know, GM might be used for.
In the past, a lot of your work manifested itself as performance, as texts, as videos, as public interventions. Is that still the way that you communicate the outcome of the project work?
We do a lot of workshops in labs and kind of specialty spaces. So those might be universities or science labs or new permaculture or food forest farms. Yeah, we usually try to have an edible aspect of each of our projects. So at least once when a concept is manifest, it's important to us that we pull together actual edible material today to ground ourselves in the world as it exists, and also to ensure that people are putting the art or the experience in their body. They're opting in a way that's not just optic, but that's haptic and physical, digestive.
Getting the art in their bellies.
Yes. Yeah. And I think the kind of dangerous aspect for us as artists who I think are quite interested in complex ideas and challenging ideas is that everyone eats. And so everyone does feel, and as they should, some amount of expertise about food experiences. But that means that in the act of demystifying sort of cultural experiences, we get all kinds of lovely and sometimes quite confrontational pushback. And so it's just something to be prepared for as we're setting up these environments to sort of play out those different politics and ideas. But it is surprising because it is food and people have like a strong both cultural and personal experience. They really feel open to talk back and sometimes shout back, you know. So it's been fun, but it can get loud and rowdy.
What about the impact on you as artists? This has been a long project you've been engaged in. You're daily facing some pretty confronting subjects and some pretty tempestuous fields, including that of food systems and technologies and the changes that are going on to the planet. How does it feel to be so immersed in the subject 24/7?
Both Kat and myself have a child who's 6 years old, and Emma has now a 1 year old. And I think having to actually feed another human being who's kind of experiencing the world and tastes for the first time keeps one a bit humble. And so I wouldn't say our art has a direct impact in all of our everyday food choices and engagements. But whether we're an activist or an artist or even a scientist, we are stretching our imaginations to what's possible. And then when you have a 5 year old that decides they hate what you made for dinner, you kind of start to have some reality check. And that's both potentially challenging and frustrating, but then also a lot of fun. But I think one of the things that we can do is act as kind of pollinators. And so as artists, we're allowed into different venues. We're either welcomed or sneak our way into places like high-end biotechnology labs or extremely radical alternative farming sites. And in some cases, these communities don't have a lot in common, nor should they. But in other cases, there's actually some really important connections that need to be made. And I think that's one of the amazing privileges we have is to go between these different sites and communities of practice and kind of stitch together unexpected collaborations that can hopefully move everything forward in the most incremental way.
This sort of moving between spaces and speaking multiple languages is one of the things that I find so interesting about what the work that you do, because you speak to artists, you speak to technologists, you speak to hackers, you speak to people in the food world, scientists, and those are communities that tend to have very different languages or very different ways of communicating. But you speak sort of all of those languages. And in many ways, as you said, you pollinate or you facilitate, you enable collaboration in some cases. How does that work when you're working with people who speak such different languages and you have to be some sort of cultural interpreter?
One thing we do is to drop at least one of the languages, I hope, which is art. Maybe what we're doing is less recognizable as sort of explicitly contemporary art practice. What that allows us to do is put forward some of our other skill sets and interests, like experimenting with food, innovation around food, maybe putting forward some of our communication skills. And so our art practice, its purpose is not to communicate science or to communicate activism, but we can foreground some of those skill sets so that we can create these circumstances where different kinds of actors can come together. I think another aspect is sort of reclaiming some of the emotional or subjective ways of being that have been lost in contemporary art. You mentioned dark humor, but there's also a lot of joy and delight, and I would even say beauty, which is like kind of a dangerous word in contemporary art. But I think bringing some of those experiences to the foreground opens up people's willingness to spend time. And so partly what that looks like is crafting really beautiful objects. And so, for example, we do an artist book that we release as PDFs that are Creative Commons licensed that we want to circulate as widely as possible. But we also have really beautifully printed risograph versions that people can hold. And I think that goes for a lot of the work that we do, is actually spending time on the material and experiential aspects so that people will give their attention. And then we'll also be having some of the digital stuff to reach that wider audience and to make sure that there's circulation of those ideas.
I find that the lexicon of genomic astronomy that you've got on your website is just brilliant, because for me, it makes my brain explode with all the concepts that those words or those invented words, those neologies, just help me think maybe a little bit in the same way that you do. And I'm just curious if you can tell me more about that lexicon, how it came about, and is it being used? Are people picking up on your invented language?
Thanks for mentioning the lexicon. It's something I'm really proud of in our practice, and it kind of sits there in the background. One way that we use it is as sort of a sketchbook. And so it's a way to play with language and think about, oh, could this be a thing? And although a lot of visual art tends to say that art is the stuff that maybe language can't do, I think we're creating these neologisms to kind of put a few words together that might be a thing that can't quite yet be described or defined. It kind of guides us if we're thinking about a new project, we're wondering if it slots into any of these previous words or phrases that are in the lexicon. We hope they circulate. So I hope it's presented in that way. And I think one of the reasons it came about was the different communities of practice that we're trying to engage have these really distinct languages, technical language and slang. And so, for example, for about 5 years, we attended a lot of hacker conferences, and we were quite interested to draw from some of the language around phone phreaking and computer hacking and sort of apply that to the food system. Like an observed phenomena from agriculture, we'll hear something at a hacker conference, we'll have this sort of rough idea about like a space of play, and we'll invent a term. And then often for the next year or 2 years, imagine if that term could become instantiated as an artifact or performance in the world.
And of course, once you create a word, it exists, it describes a space or an idea or a concept, it makes that idea or concept become realizable. So in some ways, by inventing the word, you also invent the concept. Do you have are there any particular words in the lexicon that you are particularly fond of?
So many. I think there's the things like food security through obscurity is really resonating with me now. And that's thinking about shortening supply chains in part biologically. So creating farms that produce non-fungible plants, so heirloom varieties or even older grains that actually need to be separated from the large grain silos. So I think food security through obscurity is really trying to put in place agricultural practices that do not circulate well and have to stay local. And that's a sort of way that we think about biohacking that's localized and that's sort of anti-capitalist, but is excited about the fact that humans can manipulate their agricultural environments.
Last question, maybe hopeful, maybe not so hopeful, and it is about hope. What's giving you hope these days? You mentioned your kids in both of your families, and are there ways that you're feeling that the world is not going to hell?
We try to get up out of bed every day and work towards that. We've looked at food forests the last year or 2 years, and it's really coming up here in the Netherlands and in Europe in general to create places of community, to capture carbon. And everything works in them, except that they're not valued under a capitalist system. But because they're using perennial plants, that those connections and that system of planting is there for 5, 10, 50 years, and hopefully the economic system catches up. So right now, what gives me hope is people who are working with perennials or other systems that are kind of challenging to something like a monoculture soy field. You know, food forests have some permanence. They are what persists. And I feel like those kinds of projects that create things that persist means it gives the rest of the system the kind of catch up to the work that they're doing.
Zach, thank you for increasing our ways of seeing the world, our ways of understanding the world, and of course, our lexicon of gastronomy, both genomic and otherwise. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
And for more about the Center for Genomic Gastronomy, check out their website at genomicgastronomy.com. It's full of great writing, images, provocations, and all sorts of other good stuff. And their blog at genomicgastronomy.com/blog comments on emerging issues like the fast food industry's recent moves to start playing with and actually then backing off from surge pricing.
Bonjour Maxime.
Bonjour David.
Bienvenue à l'épisode Stick This in Your Mouth when we're actually doing Christmas out of season.
We are. We're in March.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Happy end of winter. So we got a piece of Christmas cake in front of us. It's actually a big old British style fruit cake. Mm-hmm. What do you think of it? It looks pretty chunky.
Yes, it looks very chunky, and I'm surprised that we're eating it in March.
Well, it does seem to last almost forever.
Yes, and that's a little scary.
It's a little scary, but it's, you know, high sugar content, so it permits it to not need refrigeration much or even anything more than a bit of a dose of brandy every once in a while to keep it moist and delicious. What's your history with Christmas cake or with fruitcake in general?
I try to stay away from it, but I have a little bit of a history. My granny used to make it for us, and I'm not very fond of it, especially because of raisins.
Yes.
She put raisins in her recipe, and I think we talked about this in the previous
you don't like installments. Raisins.
I'm not much of a raisin person.
No. Well, don't worry. There are no raisins in this recipe, just currants. Ha! So what style of Christmas cake did she make, or fruitcake did she make?
It's very vague as a memory, but it was one of those recipes that they would like keep part of it and then use it for...
Oh, sort of like a sourdough starter?
Yes.
Yeah. I saw that once in Italy, a tomato sauce, the same kind of thing. My former roommate's cousin would always use like a tablespoon of last week's tomato sauce in this week's tomato sauce. It was a kind of like continuing a weird flavor... heritage or something. So fascinating.
Yes.
So a Christmas cake sourdough starter. Yum.
Yum.
Okay. Well, we're gonna try a bit. This is the Christmas cake that my mother's family has historically made. So it's a recipe that dates back, you know, great Aunt Marjorie from 1872 or something like this. And it's full of dried fruit. You can see the chunks of glacé cherries. They're almond chunks. It's all covered in royal frosting, royal icing rather, and marzipan. It's very British.
And what makes it British?
Well, just this incredible use of a lot of dried fruit, like all the British heritage Christmas desserts, like mincemeat and plum pudding and everything. Really, you know, it's basically a representation of wealth because dried fruit in the era from which these recipes come from was costly. It was part of the British Empire's colonialism efforts to take over the world and extract value from other places where there was more people and land to grow food on. So things like dried fruit became a way to be special because it was costly. But when I eat Christmas cake now, I think, colonial, delicious. I quite like Christmas cake, but it's also a sad story. Anyway, here's a fork.
Well, thank you.
And take a big old chunk and see what you think. That's a lot of icing on that.
That's a lot of icing. I'll try to eat a little bit more cake than icing.
Okay.
Very Christmassy seasonings.
Mm-hmm. All those sort of warm spices.
Yeah. The cinnamony, nutmeggy.
Yeah. It's very, I mean, I know you don't like texture very much. This is very chompy. Like, it's very, the dried fruit is quite chunky, and so it's very fibrous in my mouth anyway.
Mm-hmm. And it's just very, it's very dense. It's very kind of moist. There's a little bit, I always find the dry fruits, whatever they are, have a bit of a rubbery texture, just a reminiscent of this, but and that might also contribute to the fact that I'm not a big fan of those types of cakes.
Well, lots of people aren't. That's what's so interesting about this kind of cake. I think it's so traditional, and yet often people don't love it.
And this one is actually,
it's a good taste.
It's a good taste, and it's also and there's no raisins.
Yeah, just those nasty little currants.
Wow.
Are you a convert?
I might become.
Are you being nice about my family?
No. I'm actually liking it more than I remembered liking it. But knowing that there's no, because there's always this scary part in eating fruitcake for me is the first bite and realizing if there is raisins or not. And then, especially if you're a guest somewhere and want to be a nice guest, you try to eat around. And so every time it's the scary part of discovering the raisins or not.
Yes. Well, there's no raisins jumping out of us. So we can celebrate. It's the merriest Christmas ever.
The big, scary raisins.
When I was young, my mother always used to decorate the Christmas cake, and I loved watching her do it because she was very good with sort of fiddly little details. And the Christmas cake is usually, it's covered in marzipan, then it's covered in royal icing. And then my mother would pipe on all sorts of lovely flourishes and add silver dragée, and then take little pieces of glacé pineapple and glacé cherries and make beautiful flower arrangements, sort of poinsettia decorations. And I was just always in awe of her when she was doing this. And now she doesn't do it anymore. And I took over, but I haven't been in Toronto with my mother's family in a while to make the decorations. So it's sort of bittersweet in a way to eat mm-hmm. this cake because it's something I feel very attached to and yet haven't had my hand in.
Mm.
Maybe I'll make a Christmas cake for Hanukkah this year.
Sure, why not?
It'll maybe be made with potatoes and have a sour cream frosting.
We're not at one more contradiction in our lives. Celebrating Christmas with a Jewish person.
It's hybrid. It's fusion. It's everything we are. It's Montreal.
Yes, it is.
Well, I wish you a very festive season. And I'm looking forward to seeing you in at Halloween in a week.
Sure.
Thanks, Maxime.
Au revoir.
Bye.
One of the great food thinkers of the past generation, the anthropologist Sidney Mintz, once told me, "You want to change food systems? Start a war." It was a shocking and sobering statement to hear from someone so smart. His point, though, was to underline the deep and very problematic connections among military initiatives, technological innovation, economics, and food provisioning. Today, as wars around the world are wreaking havoc on the fundamental act of getting food into people's stomachs, not to mention the preservation of identity and culture and international supply chains and biodiversity and farmland health, I just can't help but think about how profound Sidney's words were. But war is really a symptom of the fundamental disconnects that exist among different worldviews and the beliefs we hold about what humans are and how we should relate to the places we live, and to each other, of course. While it should be evident already to all of us, the well-being of humans is completely inseparable from the well-being of the planet. But somehow lots of us seem to think that we can still be wasteful and irresponsible and uncaring when it comes to our food, whether it's getting it, making it, eating it, or disposing it. Looking out for number one, as they say, is kind of baked into the exploitative and extractive mindset of contemporary capitalism and Western colonial thought. But a broader view, such as the one that indigenous knowledge systems can help enable, shows that if we don't look out for the collective first, it's going to be impossible to look out for number one. But sadly, that broader view just doesn't support the mostly industrial and corporate structures that a lot of us depend on to acquire the food we eat. Something, somehow, I don't know how, but it's got to shift. Maybe seeing through reciprocity and cycles of exchange is a starting point for that shift. Maybe. The traditional knowledges of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people here on Turtle Island are gradually starting to be better understood by settler, colonial, and immigrant types like me. The ways that humor, art, and taste can speak to our psyches differently than words are also slowly helping to shift our mindsets as well. Yet, people of my generation and those before are also kind of hampered by having been socialized into a world that supports advancing our own needs before that of others. And that, in turn, supports the more exploitative and extractive nature of corporate industrial food making. It's just a very long row to hoe, as it were. But until our differing systems can start to resolve their conflicts, that row will only get longer. So for now, I'm just incredibly grateful for folks like Jane and Zach, people who are part of the growing community working on reconciling food and knowledge systems. Anyway, that definitely goes for our amazing food questionnaire respondent, whose answers are coming up next. Dr. Amita Kuttner is co-founder of Moonlight Institute, a nonprofit organization that seeks to create frameworks for equitable and just futures. Amita has a PhD in astronomy and astrophysics from the University of California at Santa Cruz. They ran for Canadian Parliament in 2019, and then they served as interim leader of the Green Party of Canada between 2021 and 2022. Amita and I met at a Green Party town hall event here in Montreal, and during their explanation of how the Greens do politics or try to do politics, I just found my mind blown in a whole bunch of ways. At one point, I got incredibly excited about the ways in which systems, political ones, ecological ones, social ones, food ones, just don't often play well with each other. So I put up my hand and I asked Amita, would you teach systems theory to elected officials everywhere? Since I thought that that would be the only way for governments and citizens to actually start understanding each other. I was being partly serious and partly silly, but it did seem to me then like a real solution. Anyway, Amita has now moved on from politics, but I think their teaching about systems is still part of the future. I certainly hope so. In the meantime, here are their great responses to the food questionnaire. At the time of our recording, Amita described themselves as a limitless liminal life form. Amita, what is your idea of a perfect food?
Something that is tasty and provides balanced nutrition.
Of what food or food context are you afraid or distrustful?
Barbecues, like the event. Due to the meat fest aspect.
What word or concept describes a well-balanced food system?
Sustainable.
What word or concept describes why food systems often remain unbalanced?
Commodification.
Which food person do you most admire?
Whomever just cooked for me.
Which food innovation do you try to ignore?
Most pre-prepared, shelf-stable, processed foods. Like Twinkies, not preserved foods or meals, but maybe I could reduce this to whip topping or foods made of petroleum, which are gross.
What is your greatest gastronomic extravagance?
Vanilla bean custard, or maybe croissants.
For what do you hunger?
Flavor.
On what occasion do you feign satiety?
When offered a bad dessert. Please, no more dry banana or date loaves. It ruins an evening.
What do you most dislike about dinner tables?
Awkward use of space, usually, or etiquette.
What is the quality you most like in a fruit?
A balance of sweet and sour.
Which condiments do you most overuse?
Hot sauce, vinegar, and unfortunately butter.
What kinds of gardens make you happiest?
Vegetable.
Which culinary skill would you most like to have?
Pastry skills, probably lamination in particular.
If you could change one thing about nutrition, what would it be?
The quantity of calories needed to survive. As much as I love food and eating, it would be so convenient to not have to eat as much or as often.
What do you consider your greatest edible achievement?
Good savory tarts, flaky crust, caramelized onion tomato, probably.
If you were to die and come back as an edible animal, vegetable, or mineral, what would you like it to be?
A nitrogen fixation nodule on a cover crop root, though it would also be fun to be a fungus.
Where and or when would you most like to dine?
At my mother's or my grandmother's table, neither of which is really possible or likely anymore.
What is your most treasured kitchen implement?
I would like to say it's the good knives, but it's actually the dough whisk.
What is your favorite highly processed food?
Potato chips.
What is your favorite aroma?
Orange blossoms.
What spice, kitchen implement, or cookbook do you use most rarely?
I don't tend to keep things around I don't actually use. So of the ones I keep around, I think it's caraway. Seems to be only for sauerkraut at the moment, but I've been wanting to put it in a rye loaf. Alternatively, it's the piping bag.
What do you most value in your friend's food?
Love.
Who are your favorite food writers?
Michael Pollan and Mark Bittman, and if I may, Barbara Kingsolver.
Who are your favorite food celebrities?
Alexis Nicole Nelson, aka Black Forager.
With which cuisine do you most identify?
It's split between Cantonese and North Indian.
What are your favorite agricultural, culinary, or gastronomic words?
I have lots of them, so I'll go with aspic, which happened to be the nickname of one of my dogs named Aspen, because she too was a meat jello.
What would you eat as your second to last meal?
A thali, with vegetable biryani, aloo paratha, palak paneer, malai kofta, matar paneer, raita, and ras malai.
What question would you add to this questionnaire or like to ask me?
What fruit or vegetable were you surprised to find out how it grows?
And that wraps it up for now. Limitless and more than liminal laureates to my lovely guests, Jane Claus, Zach Denfield, and Amita Kuttner. Thanks as always to Maxime Giroux for his good cheer and occasional fear when sticking strange and sticky things in his mouth, and my respect and regards to the lands, waters, and living beings of Tsotsage, also known as Montreal in the colonial tongue. It is a place that has long been cared for by the Ganyankahage Nation, and today many people are sorting things out in multiple ways. May those of us who live here now continue to do our best to be thoughtful and non-conflictual stewards and custodians of this place. For notes and links, check out makingamealofit.com or follow us at Making a Meal Podcast on most social media platforms. And it's great to hear from you too. Please tell me about what you're doing and thinking and the ways that your worldviews are evolving. Next week, we have conversations with people who have spent a lot of time figuring out how media and technology play with food and cooking. And on the menu, we've got food porn, celebrity chefs, digital sensors, artificial intelligence, and science fiction. Quite the mouthful. Join us, won't you? In the meantime, as so many have said before, chi 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 and haet gold maltid.